Thursday meeting of the Alaska Yukon Historical Society at their regular meeting, listening to one of our outstanding Alaskan pioneer aviation men who were going to try to prevail on to tell us his story of how he came to get into the aviation business and tell us we know a great deal already about the history he has made along with his brothers in establishing aviation in Alaska. And Sig, we will start from there and ask you the usual questions about, for instance, where you came from, what state, and when you were born, and how you come to come to Alaska and get into aviation.
Well, thank you, Bob. First of all, I want to say it's a pleasure to be with you folks tonight. I don't feel that I'm very well qualified for talking on this subject, but I'll do the best I can. I was born in Lake Nebagamon, Wisconsin, November 5th, 1903. My dad moved up to Minnesota, where he took a homestead when I was 2 years old, and I and my brothers grew up there on the farm. Noel decided to learn to fly in, I think it was 1921. He went barnstorming. That's about the only purpose that airplanes served in those days. And in, it was the year 1923, he brought one of the old World War I airplanes up to the farm. And he left the airplane on the farm field. He went back east and he bought a pair of skis for it. But before he left, I said, Noel, when those skis arrive, would it be all right if I put them on and just taxi this airplane around the field a little bit? He said, well, if you're careful, I think it'll be all right. So I did. That was my first experience manipulating an airplane, but obviously I didn't get airborne, but I got valuable experience tearing up and down the farm field. It was a lot of fun. Noel then taught me to fly in the spring of that year. That was it was 1925 when he taught me to fly. He had airplanes in and out of our community up there, but he didn't want to solo me, so I later soloed at the Shanks Flying Service at Robbinsdale, Minnesota, in 1930. And it was that same year that Noel purchased a new Stinson Reliant and decided to fly from Virginia, Minnesota, that's the Queen City of the Mesaba Iron Range, to Nome, Alaska. There had not been any flights made from east of the Rocky Mountains to Alaska, and he wanted to try that, and of course I was very anxious to go along as his flight mechanic. So the trip took us 16 days. We had all kinds of experiences. It was my first look at a mountain, having grown up in the level country, and that was quite a thrill. We ultimately landed in Fairbanks on the 19th of December, and Noel's object, along with his wife Ada, was to get to Nome, where her parents live, by Christmas time. We made it Christmas Eve. I worked as a mechanic with Noel a number of years out here at Old Weeks Field, but prior to that, I went to the Boeing School of Aeronautics in Oakland, California, and obtained my licenses. In 1937, just about exactly this time of the year, I acquired my commercial pilot's license, and my first assignment was to go over to Nome and fly out of there. And I flew out of Nome for about 5 years, then worked my way on up the coast to Barrow, where I operated from for a period of years. And then the business continued to grow. It became necessary for me to give up my everyday flying and take an office job. And I still kind of regret that I gave up active flying. Now, perhaps there's some phases of the flying that you might be especially interested in. There were many pilots and many firms who carried on flying operations dating way back, as you know. And what would you like me to go into, Bob?
Well, I would say what we're interested in the connection with your comments would be the history of the Leon Alaska Company and how they grew and all of the ups and downs they had for at different times trying to make a go of it when things were tough. And it wasn't always as rosy, and there wasn't government subsidies, and there wasn't a lot of things that you might have now, but those were the pioneering days, and I think you'd be interested in the historical society.
Yes, well, Bob...
Don't tell us anything that's going to be embarrassing or anything like that, but we know that the Wien, like every new enterprise of that kind, had their good times and bad times.
Yes.
And I think that would be most interesting, like any pioneering.
My brother Noel started it all. We were somewhat shocked back in 1924 when Noel announced that he was going to go to Alaska to start flying. Alaska to us sounded like the other side of the world. And anyway, a conductor on the railroad by the name of Jimmy Rodabaugh and some associates had gotten an aircraft. Somebody knew about Noel down there in Minnesota, and so Jimmy wrote about sent for Noel, and that's how he came to come up, and he started flying at first with this aircraft, which was one of the War One trainers. The following year, it was proved that there was great possibilities in aviation. All the miners wanted to fly. There was the trappers and the fur buyers and all the government people that traveled. They saw the possibilities of the aircraft. They came to realize that it was a much easier way to get around than by the dog team. A group of people in Fairbanks then organized to buy a larger airplane, and there was one airplane in the United States, just one cabin airplane available, and it was also the only one that was in the United States. It was a Fokker that was built in Holland by Anthony Fokker. So Noel went back to New York and negotiated for that. And it was subsequently shipped to Fairbanks by boat and rail, and it was assembled here, and Noel did a good deal of flying with this old Fokker. That was a plywood-covered wing, and after the first year or so, it became in rather bad shape. No, this one had, this was a single engine one. Yeah. Fokker later built a three engine model, one of which was brought up by Sir Hubert Wilkins. In 1925, Noel asked our brother Ralph to come up and be his mechanic, so he arrived on the scene in 1925 and maintained Noel's airplanes for him. In a couple of years later, my brothers, Noel and Ralph, who were then joined by Fritz, they obtained an airplane of their own and started flying around serving the miners. That first airplane was one of those early war planes and was quite inadequate. So they bought a Stinson biplane, which Sir Hubert Wilkins had brought up here for one of his expeditions, and they placed that into service. That was the first think that was the first cabin plane that was built in the United States. And it was the second cabin airplane to be brought to Alaska. And that served very well, and their business continued to grow. And in 1928, I believe it was, they purchased a Hamilton Metal plane. This was a new production, and for its day, it was quite a luxury aircraft. Noel did a great deal of flying with that. By that time, they had several aircraft, and Ralph, our brother Ralph, had been taught to fly by Noel, and he was at this time engaging in active flying. It is interesting, it was during the year, I believe it was 1927, that the brothers obtained a mail contract from the government. It was during the breakup period. It was actually the first mail contract which was held by a carrier in Alaska. Ben Ileson had flown the mail as an employee of the post office department, so he had flown the mail. However, this was actually the first mail contract held by a private concern in Alaska. And it was, I believe, during the year 1930 that my brother Ralph lost his life at Kotzebue in an airplane accident. And it was shortly after that that I came up with my brother Noel.
That was a diesel-powered
Blanca, and one of the very few of the diesel-powered aircraft that ever flew in the United States. It was never determined exactly what the cause of the accident was. The diesels were far from being perfected, however. It's not known whether the engine was a contributory cause to the accident. And
that land was owned by
that airplane was owned by the Catholic missionary people here in Alaska. There was I believe two priests who were with him at the time that the accident occurred. They all lost their lives.
I was talking to Bishop Tremont at the time about it and expressing my sympathy for the loss of the plane. So and I said that just before the accident where they lost the plane, I've asked Bishop Tremont how this plane was working out as a means of moving around from mission to mission instead of the slow method.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, he says, Poppy, the extent of those things is something terrible. I'll never forget that.
It has always been very costly to operate aircraft, and it is right down to this day. Well, my brothers, this was before my arrival, they sold their concern to a firm which was headed by Ben Ileson, and the large corporation was American Airlines at that time, and that was later taken over by Pan American and subsequently came to be what is now Pan American route in Alaska. Noel then started up another organization, and he purchased a Blanca aircraft from this same missionary society. And then he merged, after a period of time, with another firm which had started up over at Nome, and also established an office at Fairbanks called Northern Air Transport. And the merged company then later became the present Wien Alaska Airlines. And at first, as I mentioned, I was a mechanic for the company, for Noel, and then later took on active flying duty, and in 1940, Noel, who was president of the company at the time, asked me to take over that position, which I have held since that time.
As president of the company?
Yes.
Do you remember what became of Philip Johnson, who was managing the first operation before the Pan Am pivot over?
Yes, that was Arthur W. Johnson. I lost track of him.
He went to the States, so I thought maybe he'd keep in touch with somebody in Alaska.
Well, that was the last I heard of him. Well, during the years since 1940, our company has continued to grow. It hasn't been without a lot of setbacks and occasionally heartaches, and of course, we have been affected by problems that affect many Alaska concerns. We were undercapitalized, and we never had the aircraft that was designed especially for Alaska use. We always had to use aircraft which were designed for use in the States, and we used, I guess, about all of them, and they served the purpose.
But you finally got this one from Switzerland that Noel told me was really out of the world as far as airplanes were concerned for Alaska use.
Well, that's right. Through the years, we have searched for an aircraft, particularly for the bush type of service that would do a better job. And when we read about this Swiss airplane, Noel promptly went over there and inspected it, and we saw its possibilities. And just why the Swiss should hit upon the happy combination is kind of a mystery. They designed the airplane primarily for their own use and for flying up onto the glaciers. Their glaciers are quite high.
High altitude.
Yes. So they designed it with the ample wing area and designed the landing gear to take skis. They designed a very excellent ski for it. And they installed the large door, which is very desirable for use in Alaska. And to quote Andy Anderson, who has used it probably more than any of our pilots, he said, I wonder how those people back there in Switzerland knew just what I needed up here. And it has proved a very wonderful airplane for our service. Recently, we put into service our second one of these aircraft. They are called the Pilatus Porter. This later one is powered with a turbine engine, and this aircraft was the first single-engine turbine-powered aircraft in the United States. So it can be seen that the American manufacturers are kind of dragging their feet when it comes to designing aircraft for our use here. We've had to go abroad to find them.
I don't suppose there's anybody in the United States today that realizes that the higher you go with airplanes, the more effort it takes to stay up there. Flying altitude, for instance. Ben Alton gave me my first ride on an airplane in that first Jimmy he brought up here, and he did all the stunts that he could think of. And when I got my feet back on the ground, I sort of prayed a little, and I said, if anybody ever gets me off the ground again in an airplane, they will have to hogtie me and blindfold me and everything else. So I was up at the field one day when Noel was doing a little work on the first plane he had here. And he said, Bobby, I'm taking this plane up for a little tryout. He said, I was up there in my car with my wife and baby, and driving around, and he said, I want to take this machine up to try it out a little. I've been doing some work on it. And I said, listen, Noel, I have taken the pledge that I'm not going up there anymore airplane. And I tell him the experience I had with Ben, who did everything you can think of to scare a fellow to death. So I said, Well, if you're just going up and not doing any stunts, you know, I said, maybe I'd like to go with you. I'd like to just lean back from the position I was in about airplanes. So he said, I'm not going to do any stunts. So he took me up and we sailed around over the town and came on back down as nice as you please. And that's what brought me back to the point where I didn't mind riding an airplane again if I had confidence in the pilot. And everybody had confidence in Noah Wheel. One of the things that impressed me so much about Noah Wheel, I knew all the aviators that were in the country, and they were high-strung, nervous type, and high life, and some of them drank a lot of whiskey and what have you. Noah Wheel didn't even drink tea or coffee. That's how positive that he wanted to maintain a condition that he knew if anything happened to that airplane, it wasn't because he drank too much coffee that morning or something else. And that impressed me, and through the years, that has paid off nicely because he's one of the few, I guess the only pilot that started in those days is still alive. I don't know who else, but of those first really, the first pilots that came here. Hey, Bennett.
What came him? Bennett went to Idaho, and for a time he was commissioner of aviation, and he used to fly a Cub around there. I heard about him for years, and I think he's still there, but I believe that his eyesight failed him.
I know I've forgotten about him. I know him very personally, and he was one of the guys that he'd take three or four shots of whiskey before he'd even start out. I mean, I saw him.
I made the first trip to Chandelier. I never went in there with him, but I just took a certain amount of whiskey before he kept me waiting, and all of a sudden he had to go.
he came in from Live and Good one day with, a six-cylinder rig, and I think three or four cylinders were hitting once in a while, and he just barely come over the housetops and through the streets and finally landed.
He went up to Eagle.
I never saw anything like it.
And cracked up from the ice, and then he
picked it up and
was
playing up with some
bailing wire
and put bare grease
for oil. And I saw him come back coming out of
Chattanooga,
and I started to
make
just like a wounded
turtle. That's right. He couldn't make any altitude. Just barely he had to go through the valley to get here. Coming back from over there.
Yes, I guess there was a lot of different types of pilots in those days.
You're telling me.
And there was a lot of different types of airplanes, and it's quite remarkable how well they did, considering what they had to work with. And of course, in those days, there was no such a thing as radio in the aircraft. There was very few prepared airfields. The pilots had to use natural landing areas such as river bars and mountaintops and beaches. It was,
remarkable. There were not more accidents.
Yes, it was.
I made that first trip to Nome with an all metal plane.
Didn't you? Mm-hmm. Well, that airplane had a little history. It made the first round trip between the eastern and the western world when Noel made his trip to North Cape Siberia to pick up a load of furs for this fur company, and it was that the same run that Eielson later lost his life on, but that was actually the first trip between the east and the west. I guess there had been a trip made one way when the world round the world flyers crossed the Bering Sea, but there hadn't been any the other way. I'd like to tell you kind of an amusing little incident that happened to me once, if you'll bear with me. It was during the period following the war, and I was based at Barrow flying for the Navy. Our company had a contract with the Navy, and that summer, boats were to bring supplies and to establish the Barter Island base. So since the Navy wasn't too sure of their navigation in the waters along the North Coast, they wanted radar screens located so that they could kind of keep their bearings. These radar screens were just a kind of a framework with a screen on it, and they would be erected and face the ocean, and the radar on board the aircraft could shoot at them. They were a target. They would register. Well, we were to spot these every 50 miles along the coast of between Barrow and Barter Island. That's a distance of about 300 miles. Obviously, we had to take our landings as we found them, and I was flying the Norseman. They wanted one of these on what they call Cross Island. It's an island about 220 miles east of Barrow, and about 15 miles out into the ocean. It's just a sandbar that just comes out of the ocean, and it's formed in a crescent shape, and about a mile long. So my Norseman was on wheels, and I located an area to land and made a very good landing. We offloaded the materials, and I walked over the area to see if it was suitable for taking off. Didn't want to get into any trouble out there because it felt kind of out of the way. But anyway, I had just applied the power, and the wheel struck a soft place and buried itself right in the sand, and that wound up my propeller. So I got through to Barrow on my radio, and they came out with a seaplane, a Norseman on floats. We went back into Barrow, and so the next day, with the mechanic, we were flown back over to Cross Island by the Norseman on floats. The pilot of the airplane was Everts. So among our equipment, we had a spare propeller and an oil drum, miscellaneous ropes and gear. We beached the float plane, that is, we taxied up so that it was beached, and we offloaded our stuff, and we got busy and were carrying this stuff over to the plane that the propeller was to go on. And looking back, we suddenly noticed that the release of the weight, the lessening of the weight in the airplane, it had floated up, and the wind was carrying it out to sea. Well, this was quite a predicament. But it looked like it was going to cross this this bight and possibly just to hit that other tip of the island. So I grabbed this barrel, I don't know just why, and we struggled around there, and we had ropes with us, and finally I got over to the tip there, and it dawned on me that if I could find some driftwood to stabilize that barrel, it might actually serve as a raft in case the drifting plane missed this. And our mechanic was Phil St. Clair. He was quite a chunky fellow and light complected. But he had gone around a more distant route. So just as we got there, this Norseman, it changed its course, just gently drifting along. And it was passing that tip of that sandbar by about 30 feet, but it was pretty deep water. And Phil St. Clair was running along, and he was yelling, "I'll get that airplane." And I looked over there, and here he's throwing his clothes off as he's coming, you know. And it was quite a sight, and when I saw what he was going to do, I started yelling at him, "Don't try it, Phil. You can't stay in that ice water." There was ice cakes floating around there too, so that's pretty cold water. And so he came and he made a flying jump out into this water, and he let out a screech, and he scrambled back up on the shore there, and I was very happy about it because I could just visualize losing Phil there in addition to the Norseman. And anyway, I found some pieces of driftwood, just little short stubs, and I took a rope around that in the barrel, and we also had a number two shovel along. So a very hasty consultation was held as to who was going to mount the barrel. So I got the assignment.
Using the shovel for a paddle.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the wind wasn't strong, but it doesn't take very much to drift the plane, you know. And so I got balanced on this barrel because it was pretty tippy with just one rope around it. But having gotten balanced there, I took off after the Norseman, and after a chase of maybe a half mile or so, I caught up to it. I pulled right up between the floats and crawled on board, and then I taxied it back.
You
that was...
What did you do with the barrel?
I just left the barrel there, and the plane taxied right back to shore.
Oh, that's right. That's
and we finished putting the blade there, the propeller, on the other aircraft.
You folks haven't lost many airplanes, as I recall reading the accounts of various accidents through the years. I don't think you lost a few, but you found a few. But it seems to me that you haven't lost many planes.
Well, I think that our record is pretty good. Our type of flying, especially the bush flying, is introduces a lot of hazards. We're operating where there aren't many fields, and we're operating on skis in the winter and on floats in the summer. So, in the bush aircraft field, we have a casualty once, but I think it's not. It's a pretty fair record. Now then, possibly somebody here has a question they'd like to ask.
What was the first price of the Nome experiment?
The dog team fares were pretty much adapted, although when Nome started carrying passengers, the dog team rate was $1,000 per passenger, but he cut that rate to about... 700 or 750, and then it kept gradually getting lower and lower until it's $50 now. The interior was quite luxurious, but the pilot sat right out in the leading edge of the wing, which was all open. He didn't have a windshield or anything in front of him, and he could actually reach out and touch various parts of the engine. So it was not a very comfortable ride for the pilot.
Oh, boy.
The aircraft didn't have brakes on it, so it was handicapped on... The pilot was handicapped going into short runways because he could just land and wait for it to stop. And it had a tail skid, and that would drag. That was the brake.
No reversible propellers in those days. There are no flaps to hold to that.
Well, that was, that was an interesting... trip. It was the first commercial flight between Fairbanks and Nome. It was in the year 1925. I wasn't up here at the time, of course. My brother Ralph accompanied Noel as a flight mechanic, and then there were several
passengers,
including
this fellow Steins and Dick Woods.
Well, now here's the story on that. They couldn't get through because of weather, so they had to land at Ruby, and there was a small field right kind of up on the bluff from the river. It was during the breakup period, so that the frost was just going out of the ground. It was very soft, so the landing was made okay, except that the wheels cut in, and the plane stood up on its nose. The propeller was wooden, so of course it was shattered. The passengers were kind of disgusted about this, and they hired a boat to finish their trip. They went down the Yukon and around, but Noel was able to phone back to Fairbanks, and that was it. Ralph was still at Fairbanks, so he got into the boat with the new propeller and headed downstream and got to Ruby and installed the propeller on the plane, and they took off then for Nome. So they beat the passengers to Nome after all.
Did Noel ever tell you about the time he landed up out of Nenana ways and mushed into Nenana and never said anything to anybody on the bed? And the whole country around here was wild and organizing groups to be looking for him. He went to bed and went to sleep, and the next morning he went in to pay his bill. And oh, the fellow says, "You're weeing. My God," he says, "the whole country's looking for you." And Noel was as unconcerned as, you know, as could be, and didn't realize that what was happening to us.
Yes, Noel has told me about that trip, and that was an example of the things that they ran into in those days. It was on the first flight to Wiseman and the first flight north of the Arctic Circle, so far as is known. Noel made his landing at Wiseman and refueled there. And on the return trip, he encountered extremely strong northeast winds, which were actually of a greater velocity than the flying speed of the airplane. And it kept drifting him off, and he knew he was being drifted off course, but there wasn't anything he could do about it. And those planes were very slow, had a very slow flying speed. So he ended up down on the Kantishna River, southwest of Nenana, and it was just before the snow had gone off. It was just melting, I suppose, very close to this time of the year. A little bit later, he made a landing on the river bar. His landing was okay, but being no radio in the country or on the aircraft, he knew nobody would know where to look for him, so he started out hiking. And he knew where Nenana was, so he headed for Nenana. It was a distance of, I believe, about 40 miles. And the rivers were just in the act of breaking up, so they were full of water, but they weren't flowing full. But he would have to wade through this icy water. And he had practically no food. He did have matches, but because he was soaking wet, he had no dry place to lay down. So he would build a fire from time to time and warm up and rest up, and then head out again. And in those 3 days that he was hiking that distance, he lost 20 or 30 pounds. That's a good way to reduce.
You just said this town was wild and excited. And then when he got into the hotel, he just went to bed and never said word. The fellow running the hotel didn't know who he was. He was just another trapper or somebody come in. And just, boy, did Noel get bawled out about that by his friends. Why the devil didn't you power up and tell us? Why didn't you go down and send that telephone message up here?
Well, I suppose he was glad to not have too much fuss over it.
He just didn't realize. Nowadays, a person's overdue for an hour and a half with the United States Army and everybody else and the Air Force are tearing around here trying to look at.
Yes. A helicopter would have come in pretty handy then.
Oh, yeah. Was any questions anybody would like to ask Mr. Williams? We have told us one rather funny situation
with
that.
Well,
your stories about individual flights.
Well, of course. Well, the routine flights, of course, they're never interesting. Nothing happens. During the period that I was flying, it was during the war. I was flying over to Diomede Island quite a little bit, and we would land on the ice between the two islands. Well, on one trip, there was a Mr. Ernest Greening and a fellow called himself Muktuk Marston, and then I think Rusty Herline, I believe, and some others, and I took them into Diomede, and they wanted to have a day or so there. And the next day I went in, and I landed, and they were right there to meet me, and I loaded them right on board the airplane. This was a blank, and took off for the mainland. And as is usual, I was quite concerned about the functioning of the engine, because this 26 miles is mostly open water with just a few little pans of ice floating around. And I was watching especially the oil pressure gauge. And sure enough, right at what appeared to be the halfway point, the hand started to go down. It was just almost like it was fate. I was talking to Al Paleno on the radio, and I was telling him about all of this. And I explained to my passengers that I found it necessary to return to the island. I actually had quite a time deciding whether I should continue on or return to the island, because I couldn't be sure just whether I was just exactly halfway. So for some reason or another, I decided to go back. And meanwhile, the oil pressure kept going down and down and down. And all this way back, I didn't know whether we were going to make it or not. And when we got to the island, the hand hit the bottom peg. By that time, I cut the engine and glided in for a landing. And right away, I could see what happened. Here was all my oil out on the snow, a big long streak of it. And during those 5 minutes or so that I was loading up, the wind blowing had congealed the oil in the oil cooler. And when I started the engine up, because the oil was congealed, it would not circulate. Why, something had to bust, and the oil cooler busted and let all the oil out. But I had pressure on the dash there when I took off. That was just one of the things that make flying interesting.
Somebody asked me one time when I was flying with Joe Crossan, and Joe Crossan kept looking down at one side and then the other, and the pastor said, "What does he keep looking down for?" I said, "I don't know, unless he's looking for a place to light in case of an emergency. I wouldn't know. He was always looking down, you know, like he was sizing up the country with the idea if he had to land, he'd got to find a place."
I believe that the pilots who fly the bush over a period of time, they get into the habit of constantly watching for possible emergency landings just in case it becomes necessary. It might not happen for years, but finally it's valuable to know just where you're going to go.
I pioneered the automobiles up here, and you boys pioneered the airplanes. And one thing about the automobiles, when you lost your oil, you at least was on the ground.
Well, that was an advantage, Bob.
Well, yes, it certainly was.
And there's no flight very far, though.
No. It took all day to go 100 miles instead of an hour or two.
Were you flying the Arctic when Wadi Post and Will Rogers were cracked up that summer?
excuse me. I was here on the field working as a mechanic.
You've flown over that area, though, a good deal since, haven't you?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Was it ever determined what their trouble was? Was it why the cause of their crash?
I think it's pretty well established that they had flown quite a while, and their fuel was low in the tank. They weren't out of fuel, but it was low. And the airplane, when they left the water, made quite a steep climb, and it caused, because of the angle, the gas was in the back of the tank, and it was not able to get to the carburetor. That airplane was not too well balanced for this particular condition, and when he lost his power, the nose dropped, and he would momentarily be kind of out of control, having very little altitude. So it came down quite steeply, and the floats went into the water, causing a very bad crack up. That appears to have been what took place.
Had he been lost on his way?
No. No. They actually did a very good job of navigation. It was a day that the weather was very poor, the visibility was low, ceiling was low, and the maps of that area were, they just weren't dependable at all, so you couldn't fly by your maps. So they had flown a compass course to the coast, and when they came to the coast, they found this lagoon and some natives, so they landed to determine exactly where they were, and they had only missed Barrow by about 12 miles, and it was actually a very good job of navigation.
I always felt that if those Eskimos, when they came to where the big birds that plunged into the lagoon, they'd have gone out there right away.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I went to the morgue here and examined the bodies when they Joe Crossan and brought them down, and my friend Mr. Ross, the undertaker, laid them out, and I examined the bodies, and there was no question but what Sir Wiley Post was killed instantly. Will Rogers, of all intents and appearances, I've seen men beat up worse than he was and lived, and I think he got a blow. He had a blow. He was in the passenger cabin.
Uh-huh.
I think he received a blow on the head that knocked him out, and he landed in a couple of feet of water on the plane. He turned upside down. I really think he drowned. And those natives, they were all panicky, and they ran down the coast 17 miles to get that of the Southport Motor, the radio operator, what's his name, came up there to...
Stan Morgan?
Stan Morgan.
Mm-hmm.
They ran down the coast to call the attention of this radio operator that the big bird had plunged into the lagoon. And all of the only marks on Will Rogers was a red mark and blow on his head there, and it looked to me like he was knocked out, but his skull was not crushed. Red mark, and there was no other mark on him. But Riley Post was very, he was out in front, of course, and he was right down there. So,
how many planes do you have now?
I'm
wondering how big the company is, and how many employees.
Well, we have just about, I think it's 35 airplanes. And briefly to recount them by types, this 5 C-46s. We're operating one DC-4 now, two of the DC-3s, two of the Fairchild F-27 turboprops, and we have five de Havilland Beavers and two Pallas Porters, eight twin-engine Beechcraft, and about 10 single-engine Cessnas.
What's the name of this equipment that you brought from Switzerland?
That's the Pallatus Porter.
No, he said the F-47.
What year was it that you fly to June, or did you fly to June in the early days? How did you navigate through the mountains?
Well, it was done by pilotage, by visual observations of course, a map was used, especially on a first flight over an area, and just to make a note of the rivers and the mountains and various topographical details. And then, of course, the compass has always been used to check against the piloting by reference to,
this charter, you never had commercial flying.
No, we've never held a certificate or provided a scheduled service to Juneau. Noel had made a number of trips with Ford Trimotor quite a few years ago. And now we have been making charters down there, and of course we are hopeful that we can consummate this deal with Pan American and take over their route.
Yeah, that's the deal with Pan American goes through. The total price was on a fixed flight to Seattle by way of Juneau,
To Juneau?
Flight from Fairbanks to Seattle by way of Juneau.
Well, the price won't go up, I'm sure. It's been our intention to adopt Pan American's rates to start with, and we don't have any intention of raising them unless they're raised generally. So far as I know, now, there will be, of course, two airlines involved in the through route to Seattle by way of Juneau, and I certainly hope that there won't be any change of the present price.
And
how
many
We have just about 330 on the payroll now. There is one of these LSTs was left at Barter Island. After they got in there, they did not run that boat back out again.
Five to six.
I wasn't aware of what they had done with those old boats there. My work was just the flying out of these radar targets for navigational purposes. And at that time, they didn't establish any bases in between Barter and Barrow. Of course, they have since on the Dew Line. Well, all of the hearings have been held, and the case is now in the hands of the Civil Aeronautics Board for final decision. And I would expect that when they make a decision, if it is favorable, that the presidential approval will have already been obtained, because the president has to approve any route that is involved international service. And of course, Whitehorse is on that route, so it is. And so I would expect that it would become effective shortly after such a decision. But if it's a negative decision, then I don't know what would happen. I suppose
we'd...
Well, he could, but it wouldn't. No, it is unlikely that he would do that. And it's true that the Alaska delegation has done a great deal to help it along.
I would like to talk to you for a minute. And I would start out by asking you when was Brownsville, what year was Brownsville?
Well, that was in November
1930.
That's right.
And a factory representative came to Seattle and came up into our shop, and that engine was sent down to him.
Mm-hmm.
He helped load it off the dock and take it up to the shop, and under his supervision and with his help, we took it all apart.
Yes.
And we found no engine failures of any kind. From that time, I didn't know I was coming to Alaska.
Yeah.
And I took out a few studs.
I'm quite certain that there was nothing wrong with the engine. The engines, I think, were very reliable. They had a characteristic that they would kind of sputter quite a little bit in flight. That was the only thing that I ever heard that was wrong with them.
Was he coming in or taking off?
He was coming in for a landing, yes. He was
slowing down.
He was making his turn into the runway, and all of a sudden the plane just went into just a vertical dive. There was snow flurries, but I don't believe that it was thick enough to be a factor, because everybody could see the plane in flight, so that would mean that he had good visibility from his seat.
Those diesel engines, were they affected by cold weather? Any different than a gas engine?
Well, they would sputter quite a little bit while landing. Running with parked throttle, they wouldn't run very smooth. The pilot had to kind of keep beefing the throttle. It is possible, but I don't think that it did in this case. Now, the dual controls were in, and there was a passenger in the front seat there again. Why, there's no way of telling whether that was a factor.
Well, those engines evidently, Cassidy, they never got beyond a certain point. They don't use them anymore, do they?
Well, they're using all the tanks in World War
I. Tanks, yeah, but they never seem to get very far in the airplane, they don't. Probably one or two accidents and just buried people or something like this one.
Well, I think it was altitude.
The altitude could have had, that could have had a bearing. Is there anything else to,
you're talking about, you had planes up there in the early days that had no flaps. So how did they gain altitude?
Well, the flaps, of course, are not necessary to gaining altitude, and we might make sure that we're thinking of the same thing. The elevators, which are on the tail, they regulate the aircraft in the vertical plane. The flaps, what we call flaps, they're on the trailing edge of the wing, and they're used mainly for slowing up the airplane for landing, but they're used for taking off. They just merely reduce the stalling speed of the aircraft. And nowadays, most of the airplanes have a rather high wing loading. In other words, a rather small wing for the size of the airplane. So for landing and taking off, they kind of offset that by use of these flaps.
Anyone else?
Yes. It's a shame that stood out here on Cushman Street there for a long time, and it was available, but nobody wanted to do anything with it. I used to think at the time, the day is going to come when we'll wish that we had saved this old wreck. But now the day is here, but the airplane isn't.
I had an old
Pope
Toledo automobile here in 1909, but was just in the dock and 3 or 4 years before. And if I'd have just put that in a shack someplace and boarded it up and kept it now, it would be probably the outstanding automobile part of a parade that would be carried on here during golden days or something like that.
What year did you start your fourth car motor?
That was in 1936.
Will Rogers, just before they took off on this ill-fated trip of theirs, I was postmaster here at the time, and I met him in the street in front of the post office, and we were looking at this beautiful new post office building. And he said, "You have a very beautiful building for this part of the country here." And he said, "What is this, a first-class post office?" Well, I said, "No, it's a second-class post office," but I said, "I'm a first-class postmaster." he shook hands and he said, "Well, that's the first time I've had the pleasure of meeting a first-class postmaster and a second-class post office." That was one of the saddest things that ever happened to Alaska, was that Will Rogers should be killed. It was such an outstanding personality and wonderful person. I tried to get him to agree to go down to McKinley Park, and he said, "Well, that's up to Joe Cross, and he's taking me down here to this Mazuka Valley, or whatever they call this place where the Democrats are exiling the Republicans from Minnesota and the Dakotas, and I gotta go down to see whether it's a fit place to send a human being."
We'd like to hear something about the first flight from Fairbanks to Seattle.
The first flight from Fairbanks to Seattle, a small plane. Well, I don't know exactly which flight that would be. Now, that wasn't the first one, but it was, I guess it was an interesting thing, except that it was a part of a tragedy. And I played a little part in that myself as a mechanic, and it happened this way. Chester Brown, who was flying for our company out of Nome, took Al Lohman, that used to be over there, And they went up to Barrow, flying up the coast, and took some pictures of the wreck up there. And then he flew down straight across to Fairbanks. Well, meanwhile, Noel instructed me to prepare his Blanca for this flight to Seattle. And because these airplanes didn't carry too much fuel, he wanted to carry extra fuel in the cabin so as to be able to make those long flights, especially from Whitehorse across to Prince George or Seattle, wherever he might end up. So I worked up a system of elevating with a little pump gas from cans in the cabin. I had to install a fitting up in the line that comes from the tank in the wing and connect it up with the cabin and have proper valves to turn it off. So after Chester Brown got into Fairbanks, Noel took the pictures and Lohman and headed for Whitehorse and Seattle. Meanwhile, a pilot for what is now Pan American took their pictures. They had taken pictures, or Joe Crossan had taken pictures when he was up there, and they went to Juneau. Their plane was on float, so they could go down the coast. There was no fields to speak of along the coast, so it had to be a float plane operation. So while Noel was in Whitehorse, they received word somehow that the other aircraft, which was at Juneau, was going to take off for Seattle. So it was late at night, and it was very dark, so Noel took off, and he flew on down, and eventually they got into daylight, and they got to Seattle, I think, about 6 hours ahead of the other plane carrying the pictures. So they their pictures got there quite a bit ahead of time. And when they arrived, why, all the newspapers wanted them, even the ones that were waiting for the other pictures from the other aircraft. So it was quite a race.
He flew down, it was a single engine Blanca that he flew out.
Yeah.
Later, didn't he make some flights with the Ford?
Yes, he did. Yes. Yes, on this particular flight, I believe it was the same flight they bought the Ford trimotor. And Noel brought it back, and one of the other pilots brought the Blanca back.
What was the charge of the charter from Fairbanks to Seattle?
I don't have any idea. No.
Well, it just about winds up my tape.
Well,
no one else has any questions to ask, and it's Dick feels that he has covered the situation pretty early.
It's quite a long story, and it's impossible to cover it other than just hitting a few of the high spots in a short time like this. And it's been a pleasure to be here with you.
Well, I think you've done a fine job, and you've given us some historical tape here that will be mighty interesting in the future for people who may bring up questions about aviation that there's controversial questions about, and